This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Keith Phipps, here again with
Genevieve Kosky
and Scott Tobias.
Tasha is out this week transporting some mysterious cargo across state lines. We hope for her safe return soon. In our last episode, we discussed Joel and Ethan Coen's Raising Arizona, a comedy filled with crime and mayhem. This week, we're bringing in Drive Away Dolls, which draws Ethan Coen back into a similar cinematic world, this time with the help of his wife and co-screenwriter, Trisha Cook. Drive Away Dolls stars Geraldine Viswanathan and Margaret Qualley as, respectively, Marion and Jamie. Friends and lesbian bar habitués living in Philadelphia at the end of the 90s, they decide to hit the road together after Jamie breaks up with her live-in girlfriend, Suki, played by Beanie Feldstein. After taking a job driving a car to Tallahassee, they stumble on two discoveries. One, some violent criminals want whatever they have stashed in the back of their car. And two, despite being close friends, they might have developed feelings for one another that go beyond that. All this takes place in the midst of convolutions involving a women's soccer team, a Henry James novel, and a right-wing politician played by Matt Damon with a secret past. We'll get into it all after the break.
What? Don't touch it. I saw this movie once where they come across this box and they open the box.
The case.
And it was like really, really bad.
I just want to know what's going on.
I bet it's locked.
We just want to locate your friends.
Who are you, jackass?
That's when women curse like that.
Those girls just drove off with something we need.
We gotta call the cops.
Cool your jets. Here's what we do.
Sell it back. Shake them down.
That is about the dumbest thing I've ever heard. And I'm a cop.
Okay, everyone. Drive Away Dolls. What do we think? Are we doing the Kosky family method here? Are we going to just kind of, I think we all kind of talked about it a little bit, though. But
I've already read your review and the reveal, Keith, so I don't think it will work in this context. But
well, I know Scott's thoughts on it. I don't know your thoughts on it, though. Give me, what are your impressions of Drive Away Dolls?
Honestly, it didn't leave much of an impression. I've been kind of struggling all day with like what I want to say about this movie beyond like, yeah, it was fun, I guess. I like these performers. I like the idea of this movie, and like I appreciate how like fleet it is, both just in its length and the degree to which it moves, but it also kind of felt like half of a movie to me. It felt a little, I guess, unresolved in a lot of ways, and the way it sped from point A to point B, like a lot of, I think, characterization, not even characterization, but like certain relationships didn't kind of feel as fleshed out as I would have liked, and you know, certain threads are left dangling. So I don't know, it feels like a somewhat incomplete movie, which is interesting given how like its long gestation process. But then again, given what I said last week about Raising Arizona and like being the kind of movie maybe you can't like appreciate the greater depths of on first viewing, maybe it's something that will reveal more of itself on subsequent viewings. But did either of you like kind of see any glimmers of that I might be missing here?
I can see watching it again. There's certainly some jokes that have really stuck with me. Mm-hmm. I like it, but it's like sort of a, you know, my review is a 3-star review, but there's something that's not quite all the way there with this movie. I don't know. I'm probably the only one who's ever seen a movie called The Naked Man, which is directed by J. Todd Anderson, who's the Coen's longtime storyboard artist from Dayton, Ohio. So Dayton Pride. But it was written by Ethan Coen, or co-written by Ethan Coen. And it's just pure silliness. It's like, it's got Michael Rapaport as a guy who wrestles in like sort of a naked man outfit and goes on a revenge spree. And it is it is just kind of goes from one funny thing to another. It doesn't really quite work, but it kind of reminded me of this movie in a way, you know, where it just sort of like, there's nothing kind of grounding it. I do like, it is sort of earnest about particularly Marion's feelings for Jamie, less so Jamie's feelings for Marion. I think if that relationship had just been developed, just given a little more depth to it, I think you have a much stronger movie.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was getting at with my criticism is like their relationship, the development thereof, such as it is, which like it really kind of felt a little out of left field to me. Like I felt like I had a pretty good idea of like who these characters were as individuals, in part because they are drawn in such sharp contrast to each other. But because of that, I didn't really have a sense of what drew them to each other, either as friends or eventual lovers, other than sort of the sexual release element. You know, and I think like if there's a version of this story where it is just sort of about a sexual relationship, like that's one thing. But the fact that it does, you know, kind of resolve into a love story that shakes this love-averse character out of their cynicism about relationships, like I don't know that the film earned that. But maybe the cynical way to look at it is that this is going to resolve the way that Jamie's past relationships have resolved too. And she's caught sort of in a cycle of her own, not unlike High. So, but that's maybe getting ahead of ourselves. Scott, what did you think of Drive Away Dolls?
I think I probably liked it more than the two of you did. Mm-hmm. I think both the film and particularly Margaret Qualley's performance are kind of an acquired taste. It took me maybe a bit to settle into the movie, much as I enjoyed whatever happens to Pedro Pascal at the beginning of the movie. It's a silly film, but it's also, it's short, it's fast, it's full of energy. It has tons of supporting performances that I really enjoyed, and lead performance. I mean, I do, again, Qualley is an acquired taste that I did eventually acquired, but Viswanathan is an actress who I always love to see in a comedy. I think she's really fun in this one. Love the buddy dynamic between the men trying to track them down, and their different approaches is very, you know, Joey Slotnick, is that the actor?
Yeah,
he's mm-hmm. just he's that's a real standout performance.
Yeah, you feel like he should have been in Coen Brothers movies for years.
Oh my god,
yeah, kind of
just it fits just like, right into it.
Yeah, it's just like, oh man, and their whole odyssey and their involvement with the women's soccer team, all that's really funny. I think Bill Camp is just a complete scene stealer in this as Curly. I love his.
Yes, but what happens to Curly? Is he still lying on the floor of that driveway place?
Like, it depends on. It all hinges on one question.
Yes.
No one saved Curly.
That is so good. I mean, like that line alone is just kind of worth the price of admission for me. Also, the moment where he tries to flip up the papers, but the window's like too fogged or something for the person to see. It's just like, to go back to the Raising Arizona thing, this movie is such a way homer for me. I did enjoy the speed of it and enjoyed watching it. And then I just, you know, the more I kind of think back on it and think back on the characters and certain lines and just, you know, I laugh at it. And I really laugh at just, you know, the idea of this briefcase too. I mean, you know, the briefcase is familiar from to us from Kiss Me Deadly, of course, which that then was paid homage to in Pulp Fiction. And it's always something just incredibly important, like important in the case of Kiss Me Deadly, like world-ending stuff, right? So to learn what the actual contents of the briefcase were, it's just, that was just so inspired. I thought it's so funny, you know.
I will give them that they got me with the briefcase fake out, because before it was revealed what the briefcase actually contained. I was like, oh man, we should have paired this with Big Lebowski or something. I thought it was going to be a drug story, you know. But you know, it's, and I think the film even kind of makes you think that up until the very last moment, right up to when she is like kind of orgasming in a way that it could also be an overdose, you know.
Yeah. Oh my god.
But I guess I appreciate like how fully this commits to being a sex romp, specifically a lesbian sex romp, and it takes that all the way down to the sort of crime mystery element of it. So I can appreciate the commitment there.
In the midst of like so all this discussion of how you know sex doesn't belong in movies, although I always feel like maybe that's just a little bit overblown, a little bit like Twitter centric than an actual sentiment. Like I did appreciate the frankness and sort of the joy that this film brought to its depiction of sex.
Agree.
For sure. Yeah, definitely. And I guess we're going to get a mini wave of these things, right? I mean, we do have Love Lies Bleeding on the horizon, maybe some you know, maybe the lesbians will show us the way, but it's like I was like thinking with the one thing I was thinking about too with Driveway Dolls is that I think we know now which Coen brother was responsible for the machine that George Clooney builds in Burn After Reading, right? Oh my god! I mean, speaking of George Clooney, I feel like Margaret Qualley's performance is sort of like her doing George Clooney in a Coen Brothers movie. It's just it's a very strange piece of work that I guess she commits to, which, and I think it pays certain comic dividends, but I think where I would agree with you all is that I think because it's such a mannered performance, it kind of severs the possibility of the central relationship having, you know, the warmth and feeling that I think we kind of hope from it, as much as I think those two personalities sort of ping off each other quite well comedically.
You talked about being a way homer. I wonder if culturally it's going to be a way homer because it did not do very well at the box office. It was released widely instead of being platformed, which was kind of an unusual choice for this sort of film. And people did not go see it. They went to see the Bob Marley biopic instead. And this is better than that for sure. Do you think it'll kind of pick up a second life as people discover it?
It's kind of inevitable in a way. I mean, when you're a Coen brother, your films are going to get watched. I can't think of a movie that either of them have directed that has not been studied pretty closely. So I would be pretty surprised if this did not find some sort of second life. Though I guess it has the potential to not find, given how few people saw it and liked it. It may not have, it may have a ways to go to become kind of a cult movie. But it might. It's distinct, though. I mean, it what's like it now? Who makes movies like, you know? I mean, people went and saw the Bob Marley movie. I mean, who's going to remember that thing? Like that's just another biopic, like every other biopic. It's like so at least this is a movie that is unusual in so many different ways. It's the rhythms of it, Qualley's performance being what it is, you know, the dildos everywhere, you know, and it's just kind of like, you know, it's short, you know, it's just, there's something, you know, unusual about it, and that some unusual usually, you know, keeps people, you know, at least the people who kind of keep track of movies after the first weekend they're released interested. So I think it stands a chance of second life. It also goes to my thing, which is like, you know, I always feel that films that I like are going to be appreciated down the line.
Right.
I think this has cult potential because I like it.
Yeah. I don't know how much stock you can place in sort of the idea that, you know, Coen Brothers movies are going to get seen, given, you know, this is not a Coen Brothers movie. And I don't know. Is Tragedy of Macbeth, like, that was hard. That's hard to say because that was like on a streamer. Apple. But like So like, I don't know what that second life potential is either. But the point being, like, I don't know how strong the brand is when they're separated. Mm. So I guess there's nothing to do but wait and see there. But like, as far as this movie goes, I hate to say this, but I think it kind of depends what streamer it ends up on, you know, and like where people will find it. Because I think like taking the Coen out of it, I think it's just like a hard movie to sell in terms of like, what is this? Like, it's not like engaging with any sort of known property. And even like the trailer doesn't really give you that great of an idea of like what kind of movie it is, I guess. But I think like if it lands on...
Well, it's going to be on Peacock. It'll be it's focused features. So you'll watch The Traitors, and then you'll watch Beverly Hills Dolls.
I guess it could potentially break out on Peacock. I don't think like necessarily enough people have it. I think basically it needs to land somewhere where people can stumble upon it and be surprised by it, which I think Netflix, for all its all the terrible things it's done to the industry, like it is like kind of good for like resurfacing old stuff that like kind of went under the radar before. So that might happen here, but I feel like this is a movie that it's probably best gone into with low expectations and light curiosity that it can outperform, I guess, you know, that an audience can be surprised by it.
If Margaret Qualley joins the royal family, this will be her Suits on Netflix, right? This will be like her Suits. You know, it got made. And, you know, the people continue to, and it's kind of neat that this was something that Cohen could do with his wife and professional partner for a long time, Trisha Cook, and really kind of, you know, be a movie that at least by reports, it was, you know, kind of equal project, a project where she was doing a lot of sort of the direction and the writing and, you know, determining how this movie got made. It's neat and it's new. And, you know, I mean, as much as I long for the Coens to kind of get back together and make To the White Sea or whatever it is that they want to make, it's kind of interesting to see them break off and try different things. And even if, you know, in their own ways, The Tragedy of Macbeth and Drive Away Dolls kind of make you miss the other one a little bit and what the other one might have brought to each one of those projects, it's kind of interesting to see what they're doing on their own.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess before we leave this discussion and Trisha Cook's contributions, like, you know, she is the queer voice in this this dynamic, which is perhaps unexpected when you hear that she and Ethan are married, but they have a very non-traditional relationship that I feel like the promotion of this movie has brought out into the open more than, you know, maybe a lot of people were aware of previously. So I think like she brings a certain authenticity to this story and these characters, and just like the desire to tell this story in this time, in this space. Cause like if this was a pure Coen Brothers movie, it might feel like a little anthropological, I guess, in terms of this world and these characters. So I think to the extent that this movie does feel authentic, which, you know, that's debatable, but the sort of where the comedy comes from, I think is kind of pure in that respect. And I think that can probably, I would guess, be attributed to Trisha Cook more than Ethan.
There's a good article on Movie Maker about the making of this movie. It kind of gets into their whole relationship as well. But I thought it was interesting that she talks about it as being kind of a time capsule, because there's not really that much that marks it as a 1999 movie other than the absence of modern tech, you know, our cell phones and such. But she talks about how that being kind of a high point for lesbian bars, and lesbian bars kind of being sort of an endangered, you know, institution, and it is kind of in this way, it's kind of a visit to a lost world, which nothing I would have known about outside my experience. So it was kind of interesting to learn that as well.
Yeah, that was a fun aspect of the movie. I mean, it's a very sort of liberated, sex positive, fun movie. In kind of all of these encounters that they have and all these different bars they get to go to, you know, feed into that as well. And really kind of at least enhances the sort of the comic dynamic between the two leads as well. I mean, you know, right from the beginning, you get that, you know, first club that they go to, and Geraldine Viswanathan's character is dressed as she's normally dressed at work and looks completely out of place, where Mark Pauly's character just kind of owns the room. You know, I mean, there's this unabashed sort of lustiness to her as a character that's just so winning and kind of freeing and fun to see represented, I guess, on screen.
All right, well, those are some interesting thoughts on Drive Away Dolls, and we'll have more such thoughts after the break when we bring back Raising Arizona and see how these two compare to one another.
Don't! What are you doing?
I don't want it anymore!
Who sent you would it be here?
Suki, I'm just taking my own stuff. That was a gift. I wanted you to have it.
I don't want it, and we're not going to both use it.
Suki, it's your wall dildo.
No, don't. Take Alice, too. I never liked her. And she won't stop barking.
How can I take the dog, Suki? I don't have a home. Remember, you kicked me out.
Now it's time for connections when we bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. I think, you know, where to start? I think maybe just sort of the general sensibility here. Like, where do we see the comedic sensibilities of these two films connecting? I'll throw out just the elevated use of language throughout. But I mean, Quali's character and Joey Slotnick's character in particular get sort of some of the choicest bits of dialogue in this film.
Yeah, and I think there's sort of a link you can draw between Margaret Qualley's character, Jamie, and Nick Cage's High as these very loquacious leads. You know, they just talk. They can just talk. They have the gift of gab, you know. And Raising Arizona, I think we get that a little more in High's voiceover than necessarily dialogue interactions. I mean, he's still a pretty talkative guy, but I think, you know, maybe John Goodman's character is the most verbose of the movie, and is maybe you can connect him to Joey Slotnick's character maybe a little in terms of secondary characters. But I think like that is a little bit of a Coen signature, sort of a protagonist who can talk, you know. Again, I'm thinking of George Clooney in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou as another example with a robust accent to boot. So
the difference, I think, is I think feel like this is more Marion's story ultimately, right? I mean, Jamie is Jamie, and she is sort of the catalyst for change, and Marion is the one who undergoes, you know, a certain amount of evolution in terms of how she wants to be in this, you know, to be herself, to be fuller herself, to understand how she feels about her sexuality, to understand how she feels about Jamie. This is kind of this whole adventure sort of spurs her on, and she's not nearly as loquacious, though she does carry a certain amount of power and a certain amount of like stubbornness too. To you know, she can be quite willful.
I love that early scene at her office where the poor guy is trying to ask her out, and she keeps saying, what's her phrase, like, I have an engagement, is that it? Yeah yep. And it's again sort of that like heightened formal language as comedy getting trotted out there in a slightly different context. But I don't know. I kind of feel like it is, like, I get what you're saying, Scott, about it being Marion's story, but I keep coming back to that damn message on the trunk in this sort of like, I don't even remember what it ends up, but what, love is a like sleigh ride to hell. And then she changes it to, Yeah. And I feel like there's a reading of this as a relation that's about Jamie, like learning to have a relationship outside of sex, you know, or learning to love within a sexual relationship. I don't know. It's fuzzy. I don't think the film has a super strong grasp of what it wants to say about this as a romance.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, maybe that's kind of another connection to Raising Arizona, between, you know, the romance between High and Ed, which is debatable as sort of a love story for the ages, you know, like they're a couple that kind of impulsively gets together, you know, as a matter of circumstance, you know, after she's been left by her fiance, and you know, and he's trying to break this cycle of recidivism. Like, it's, you know, they're both, you know, trying to fix something about themselves in the other person. And, you know, the film ultimately lands on a note of ambiguity of, you know, where they're going to end up. And Drive Away Dolls is less ambiguous in that they are literally running off to get married, but I don't think it gives us any reason to believe that their relationship is necessarily one that is going to stand the test of time more than Jamie and Suki's did, for example. But I don't know. maybe I'm being cynical. I think both of these couples, you could be optimistic or pessimistic about their future, because neither is a slam dunk love story, I think.
I would be optimistic about Jamie and Marion. I think to hear you kind of talk about that relationship and sort of Jamie's role in it, the way Jamie has sort of changed as well. Like I think that a really key scene in the movie is the scene where everybody's making out, where they're making out with all the with the soccer team, and everyone's rotating, and it finally gets the two of them together. And it's a tough situation for both of them, because it means something for them. It's not, you know, making out with some random person. You know, which is something that Jamie would be super comfortable with compared to Marion. But I think there's a real charge in that scene, and a real feeling that if they go through with it, that there's something, they're crossing some sort of a bridge, you know, there's something real there that's only that they haven't gotten the courage or gotten to a point where they can kind of really acknowledge yet. So I like that little scene, because I think it really sets up the relationship, you know, growing from that point on.
Well, I guess to expand this connection a bit, like, in addition to being sort of love stories, these are also each crime stories in their own way, sort of inept criminal stories, yeah. Although Jamie and Marion, I mean, I guess they don't really technically do a crime until the very end, and it is, you know, treated as a triumph, you know, but they are certainly involved in a criminal, what's the word?
Scheme.
Yeah, unbeknownst to them, and they certainly don't have the capacity to necessarily deal with it, you know. They have to bring in Beanie Feldstein's Sookie, a cop, to sort of help, although the degree to which she helps is, you know, mostly comic relief, I would say. She does carry a mean dog, though.
Yeah.
But I think it's interesting to think about in terms of Raising Arizona's, you know, supposed quote-unquote crime, which obviously kidnapping is a crime, but the movie frames it in such a way that it just never feels that serious, you know, and it never feels like the stakes are that high with this. And certainly the way it resolves kind of underscores that feeling, you know, and that nobody gets hurt other than the actual, like, violent criminals, I guess.
The baby gets, like, is on top of the car at one point and survives that. So Nathan Jr. is a pretty durable child. Yeah, I mean, that is just Coen bread and butter. I mean, that is something that they have done since Blood Simple, and then Raising Arizona, and then a million other movies in between, is this idea of amateurs either committing crimes or being, you know, drawn into criminal schemes. I mean, this is what they love to do, and can spin so much, you know, comic fun out of those scenarios. You know, I mean, here, of course, you get that those guys who are kind of trying to track them down, and that dynamic you see so often in their movies. You see it, of course, in the with John Goodman and William Forsythe in Raising Arizona. You see it in Peter Stormare and Steve Buscemi in Fargo. I mean, these are the kinds of criminal duos and dopes that they could just have all kinds of fun with. You know, usually you have a talkative one and a less talkative one, and that's all you really need. You know, and then just, you know, people who are just ill-equipped to attempt what they're attempting. Non-pros. These are the opposite of Michael Mann characters. These are people who don't know what they're doing, and there's so much fun to be had in that. I mean, that's also the Burn After Reading thing too, which feels so much of a piece, so much an Ethan Coen-y type of project. Burn After Reading does, with these gym trainers who are trying to find themselves at the Russian embassy with this disc that they think is of incredible value. I guess the difference is maybe the body count is slightly lower here. I guess you get a little bit of Driveway Dolls, but it can get pretty bloody in a Coen Brothers film over nothing. I mean, Burn After Reading is a perfect example of just like so many people die over absolutely the dumbest possible thing. And this is, I guess, neither of these films really, you know, have quite so gruesome a result.
Coleman Domingo and Joey Slotnick get it, you know, pretty abruptly and ruthlessly. But then again, they are sort of the actual criminals, you know, in this story, such as it is, you know. So they get the punishment of the crime and punishment combination tracks. It's kind of interesting that Raising Arizona, like in the Coens filmography, is, I think, pretty rare in offering like forgiveness and absolution and in place of punishment for you know its main crime. But that kind of goes back to what I was saying about the sort of characterization of this kidnapping as ultimately not that big a deal, you know. And you also have sort of the counterpoint of these other crimes. I'm thinking of like the bank robbery, something that has where the victims are a little clearer, I guess, and that crime being one that the perpetrators are punished for in a way. I mean, I guess they get blue paint sprayed on them, you know, but
and they return to their rightful home in jail.
Yeah.
Though they dig themselves back under.
Yeah. It's like back in defeat.
I don't think we really get a solid answer for what happens to Gail and Evel, because when we do see them digging back into prison, it's part of sort of that closing dream sequence that imagines, I guess, like the best case scenario for High's future, you know, but it is left open-ended and ambiguous. So I don't think we can say definitively what happens to Gail and Evel the way that we know definitively what happens to sort of their analogous characters in Driveaway Dolls.
Well, yeah, because they're killed.
Well, Joey Slotnick is, and Coleman Domingo sort of their boss figure is, but CJ Wilson, I guess, who plays Flint, you know, he's the one that shoots them both, and then he just scurries off, you know.
Yeah.
So again, as with Bill Camp, sort of an element of the crime story of Driveway Dolls that remains unresolved. But maybe that's an unexpected connection to Raising Arizona as well, given that the ambiguity of how where all these criminals, to the degree to which they pay for their crimes, I guess.
We could talk about the different cinematic references these films bring in, which I think that are many, like down to a pretty obvious homage to Some Like It Hot at the end of Driveway Dolls. But I mean, not to use Raising Arizona to further criticize Driveway Dolls, but they feel a little lumpier in Driveway Dolls, like just like a little bit of noir here, a little bit of sort of road movie there.
Some psychedelic interludes with Miley Cyrus.
Yeah,
yeah, who I didn't recognize at first. That was, but yeah, the psychedelic stuff is fun, but it also, and it does eventually reveal its, you know, true meaning, but it does feel like these strange interruptions in the break with the style of the movie for a while there, don't they?
Well, yeah, and I mean, that's kind of what contributed to what I was saying earlier about, you know, sort of the fake out of thinking this is a drug mule story, an unwitting drug mule story.
Right. So this psychedelic impact of this, which is totally a red herring.
Yeah. Yeah. That mule don't bark, but yeah, I don't know. I found those interludes in Driveway Dolls kind of distracting and maybe a little cheesy. I don't know. Maybe it's the Miley Cyrus factor. And like, I don't have any problems with Miley Cyrus. I think she's fine. but I think, you know, as far as the sort of two big cameo appearances in Driveway Dolls, that one felt much more sort of clumsily executed, even if it does resolve itself within the plot of the film by the end. But in the moment, it was just like, what's happening here? Why are we doing this? And it just like didn't feel that, I guess, visually interesting. Like it felt kind of very like my first psychedelic filter.
Pretty cliched, actually.
Yeah, and like compared to sort of the cinematography of Raising Arizona and how it has this like really kind of like Looney Tunes, the way it like places the cameras really low, so everything, you know, feels really like, you know, exaggerated and cartoonish. Just like it executes that tone more subtly in a way that feels more of the fabric of the film rather than this weird interruption that it was in Drive Away Dolls.
I think there was a thing though with that Ethan Coen is sort of trying to recapture here in terms of style that kind of goes back to the early Coen Brothers films that were shot by Barry Sonnenfeld before kind of moving forward to the Deakins era, which was Barton Fink and beyond. There's something kind of rough-hewn about both of the films, a little bit rough around the edges, I guess, in terms of the stylistic approach, in terms of just the flow of the film. I think it's almost a deliberate messiness to Driveway Dolls. It is kind of sloppy, and in the case of the psychedelic aspect it doesn't maybe work, and it seems kind of cheap and or cliched or something. But I think there's something kind of quick and dirty about Driveway Dolls that I think is part of its charm. And Raising Arizona is a little bit more refined than that, but it's still. You know, they're just making their second movie. They're making kind of a big, broad, wacky comedy. And so there's kind of a rambunctiousness to Raising Arizona that as they became more polished as filmmakers down the line, they ironed a lot of that stuff out. And so it feels like Driveway Dolls is an attempt to kind of go back a little bit to the feel of something as early as Raising Arizona. You know, and the other thing, if we're talking about Cinemac references, Keith and I were fortunate enough to see the film at a public screening that was the back end of a double feature that was being hosted by the Chicago International Film Festival. And the first part of the double feature was Gun Crazy, which is a wonderful, you know, sexually charged noir that was one of the three films that Ethan Coen cited as kind of big influences on this movie. The other one being, you know, Kiss Me Deadly, as we mentioned before. And then the third, which I've never seen, maybe, I don't know if you all have seen it, is Bob and Ted and Carol and Alice. Have you seen that? Have either of you seen that one? Do you see
it? Yeah, I saw it after Mazursky died. I haven't seen a lot of Mazursky films. I didn't see that one. It does have like sort of the sort of, you know, freewheeling spirit. I wouldn't have guessed that as an influence, but I can, you know, after the fact, I can see it.
Yeah. I mean, they like to be cagey about that stuff anyway. I mean, it's hard to be cagey about Kiss Me Deadly here because this is just kind of a direct way of kind of messing with that trope. But, you know, Gun Crazy is a little bit harder to trace. But there's certainly a tradition that the film is operating in.
I feel like we've kind of danced around talking about what the central MacGuffin is in Driveway Dolls. It's a suitcase full of dildos. but thinking about it in relation to Raising Arizona, which is, you know, structured a little different. They're not like necessarily being chased the way that they are in Driveway Dolls, but they do have this thing that everybody wants in Raising Arizona. It's a baby, and it and we do kind of have a sort of a chase pursuit element with the baby when the Snoats take Nathan Jr. But it just strikes me, you know, that these are both inherently humorous things for everyone to be handling. You know, like there's a lot of sort of funny gags with Nathan Jr. being, you know, left on the car or in the middle of the road, and just sort of the idea of the handling of this precious cargo. You know, it facilitates some pretty funny gags. It's just funny to me to think of the sort of equivalent of that in Driveway Dolls being a suitcase full of casts of famous men's penises. But they do kind of function similarly as, you know, comedic objects, I guess. I apologies for calling Nathan Jr. an object, but he kind of essentially is in this context.
He's just one of the queens.
He doesn't have a...
He's the best one, though, right?
Yeah. We're not even sure it's Nathan Jr. It's Nathan Jr., I think, right? So I don't know. Basically, I just wanted to use this opportunity to compare a baby to a suitcase full of dildos.
Yeah.
The dildo situation, the blackmail quality of it and everything, the seriousness with which everyone else treats it except for our heroines is so, I think, one of the funnier parts of the movie. I forget who it was talking about how these men don't deserve to have their lives ruined by a youthful mistake.
I think it was Coleman Domingo.
Yes,
who gets to deliver that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
That gravitas.
And also, this suitcase gets so much more attention than a severed head in a bag. Bag full of ice. Like, that is just something that's just a hassle that they have to deal with. It's really the contents of the suitcase that are far more important to everybody. Yeah. which is funny itself. I just think that's a terrific reveal, because again, you know, that kind of a MacGuffin has to be of just such incredible importance. Like, whatever is in this thing, you know, is worth dying for. All of the action of the film is being driven by this, and for it to be, you know, a suitcase full of four dildos, it's a wonderful, you know, comic idea, I think. So kudos
dildos to, that are immediately put to use too, which is one of the other funny gags in this film.
Yeah,
no hesitation whatsoever. It's like, oh, what can we do with these? I know.
And I mean, we do get Chekhov's dildo right at the beginning. You know, they told us it was coming. Yeah.
I don't think once we bring up the phrase Chekhov's dildo, there's no place else to take this conversation. So we're going to wind things down there. Although, of course, if you have any, you know, we appreciate any feedback you send. We can keep up the dildo conversation in future episodes.
Please,
if you'd like,
send it all in.
Raising Arizona is currently rentable at all the usual platforms. It's also on Blu-ray and DVD. Driveway Dolls is probably still in theaters. If you're curious at all, go out and see it now. Otherwise, it'll be on Peacock, right, Scott?
I think so. That's where they tend to go, these focus features.
We'll be right back after a short break with your next picture show. Finally, it's time to recommend a film or film-related item that complements this set of episodes. We call it Your Next Picture Show in hopes it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. Scott, you actually don't have a complimentary Next Picture Show, but you have a alternate universe version of this episode that you want to discuss, right?
I wonder what our listeners have enjoyed, a foodie pairing of The Taste of Things and Ratatouille, because that is somewhere we could have gone if the timing wasn't a little screwed up. But I did want to really recommend The Taste of Things, which is just one of those movies that kind of got a release towards the end of 2023 for awards consideration. It is out now. You can kind of see it in art houses. It's very frustrating that it hasn't quite gotten the push that I think it deserves, which is not the fault of the French. The French ended up, even though they had Anatomy of a Fall, a film of theirs that won the Palme d'Or, and got all this Oscar attention. They ended up putting The Taste of Things up for the Best International Feature Award, and then it didn't get nominated, which is just crazy to me. It is a beautiful film with Juliette Binoche and Benoît Magimel. They are a couple that late 19th century France, who are basically a couple, a gourmand and his, you know, live-in cook. The gourmand being Magimel and the cook being Binoche. And the first, like, you know, and their relationship is something that is romantic, but reserved. They're not married. He comes up to her room, and sometimes the room is open and sometimes it is not. So it's something that she kind of controls. But their love story is connected to their primary love, which is food. And the first, like, 35 minutes of this movie is just preparation of food in this kitchen, and it's just, it looks amazing. So I mean, really, so much of this movie is just, you know, a lot of really gorgeous scenes of people expressing themselves through the food that they make, which is plenty enough for me. This is a film by the French Vietnamese director Tran Anh Hung, who's done a lot of really good movies like Seek Low. He did a film called The Scent of Green Papaya, and there was a film called The Vertical Ray of the Sun that he did that from 2000 I really like that had this sort of morning routine that would be set to songs like Pale Blue Eyes by the Velvet Underground. This movie has that kind of quality to it. It finds a lot of pleasure in routines, in sort of in photography and in, you know, kind of sensual moments. It is a film that you really feel in a very tactile way and is reinforced by really, really good performances, particularly Binoche, who's just unbelievable. And I really strongly recommend it. There's a long tradition of good food movies out there, from Babette's Feast to Big Night to Tampopo. This belongs in that kind of upper echelon of food movies. So if you get a chance to see it, please check out The Taste of Things. It is a pure pleasure.
Well, that's it for this edition of the Next Picture Show, but we'll be back next week with another set of episodes. Genevieve, do you want to tell us about our next pairing?
In Rose Glass's new neo-noir, Love Lies Bleeding, Kristen Stewart stars as a lonely young woman who leads a dead-end life as a manager of a rundown gym in a dusty corner of the American Southwest. Then a beautiful drifter, played by Katie O'Brien, comes to town with dreams of making it to Vegas as a bodybuilder, and her world is transformed. Can she trust this femme fatale? And can these cash-strapped lovers free themselves from the criminal organization that's been holding her at bay? These sorts of questions are common in film noir, but the sapphic passions on display in Love Lies Bleeding call to mind the Wachowskis' 1996 lesbian noir Bound, another film about women trying to wriggle free from a sadistic gangster, even as they may not fully trust each other. In our next set of episodes, we'll look at how the Wachowskis started their wild and eclectic careers by planting the seeds for a film like Love Lies Bleeding, which brings the same passion and style to the genre.
For now, we welcome your feedback on Raising Arizona, Drive Away Dolls, and anything else film-related you'd like to talk about. Email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net or leave us a voicemail at 773-234-9730. Before we close out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Genevieve?
I am still the TV editor at vulture.com, and you can find me squatting on various social accounts at the handle Genevieve Kosky. Scott?
I'm on Twitter at @Scott_Tobias. I'm on Blue Sky at Scott Tobias. You can find my work primarily at The Reveal, the newsletter that I write with Keith Phipps. That's TheReveal.substack.com. You can find my work in The New York Times, in Guardian, and Vulture. I just had a piece, my first piece for Time magazine, so I should say I can include that. I did a piece on Elsbeth, the television spinoff of The Good Wife for them. And so I'm pretty happy about that. And I got another kind of big essay that I can't really reveal is coming out, but I'm pretty excited about that too. I can talk about that when I can talk about it. Keith, what about you?
I'm a freelance writer. You can find me at some places at the Ringer, where I just wrote a piece about making an argument for Robert De Niro as the best supporting actor for Killers of the Flower Moon. You can read me in Vulture. You can read me in TV Guide. You can also read me at The Reveal with Scott Tobias. It's TheReveal.substack.com. We always appreciate new readers there. Our absent co-host Tasha Robinson is the film editor at Polygon. You can find her at various socials at Tasha Robinson, including Blue Sky, where she's been posting quite a bit. That's our only contact with her since her disappearance, but we hope that she'll be back soon. You can stay updated on The Next Picture Show at nextpictureshow.net and on Blue Sky at The Next Picture Show. Get bonus content at Open Discussion at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. And as always, we appreciate your rating and reviews on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen to the show. Thanks to Dan the Bake Jakes for his assistance producing this podcast. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts. Please tune in next time.